Hello, beekeepers and fellow interested beekeepers. Hey, thanks for tuning in today to Studio Bee Live. I'm your host, David Burns, and Studio Bee Live is produced right here from our honeybee farm in central Illinois, Long Lane Honeybee Farms. Our website is honeybeesonline.com. We appreciate you dropping in today and checking in to what we have to say about beekeeping. We have the most fun keeping bees. I'm telling you what, it's a blast. I hope that by listening to us, you can hear our passion and you can hear our personal desire to help more people become beekeepers. It is so much fun. And today it's kind of cold here in central Illinois. Got down into the teens, probably the low teens, I believe, last night. And all of our bees in central Illinois are kind of bunkered down for the winter. They're in their boxes, rubbing their wings together, staying warm in a cluster, and looking for better days. I don't know, maybe they're sitting around the fireplace playing board games and drinking hot cocoa and thinking and reflecting back of fond memories when their beekeeper took such good care of them back in the spring and summer. And maybe they're looking forward to eventually being able to fly out again and resume activities. Hard to believe those little insects can just sit in the winter in their little boxes and cluster and stay warm and make it through the winter, but they do. Hey, speaking of the bees and going through winters and surviving cold weather, I have an email today, and a podcast listener writes in with a similar question about the bees, and let's get into that. This is from Chris Turnbull in Australia. He says, "Good day, Dave. I'm loving your podcast show because I've just got my first hive of honeybees up and running, well, flying mostly. My part of Australia is subtropical, and everything is in bloom at the moment, so the bees are having a ball. I have a question that's related to something you said in your last show about the lack of feral bees being available in the U.S. to pollinate crops as a result of their being wiped out by small hive beetle, varroa, and tracheal mites. Do you think bees will eventually be able to overcome this by adopting more hygienic behaviors, and do you think we will see the reappearance of feral bee populations in time? And is this same problem related to the successful spread of Africanized bees in the U.S.? I understand they are more hygienic and better able to deal with a number of pests." Well, Chris, that's a good question. The ability for the bees to overcome, like you mentioned, the mites and small hive beetle, it is becoming more impressive. I think no doubt we are seeing the bees being able to get rid of more of the pest in their hive. You know, this is one of the reasons that the Russian bee, the Russian queen, many people use Russian queens, and the premise behind that, I don't know, you know, how much I buy into it, because I have used Russian queens before. But the premise is, since the Russian bee has been dealing with mites, oh, I think for what, 100 or 150 years now, they are more apt to be able to break the brood cycle to get rid of them. They're more hygienic, I guess, in the sense that they are able to coexist with the mites and keep them down from being in larger infestation levels. Hygienic work in with bees is very important, Chris. I'm glad you mentioned this, because let me just tell you this. Here is the way that we find the best way to go about breeding or grafting our queens so that the bees that come from these queens are more hygienic. We're actually starting this process in the spring. But we will go to a hive that we like, one that's survived two Illinois winters, one that is a good honey producer, very gentle, adheres, the bees adhere to the frames well, and show no sign of disease, and have survive mites without any medication. From these hives, these are the hives that we graft our queens from. And one of the things that we'll be incorporating this spring is the hygienic testing. And this is when we take a metal tube, a metal pipe, about a 3-inch diameter metal pipe, and we pull out a frame of sealed brood, and we put this metal pipe, lay it against the brood, kind of just gently press it into the comb, and we pour in a small amount of liquid nitrate or liquid nitrogen. And this liquid nitrogen will instantly, of course, freeze and kill all the brood within that 3-inch diameter pipe. And then that brood frame is placed right back into the hive. 24 hours later, we go and look at this frame that we have killed a 3-inch circle of brood on with the liquid nitrogen. I keep saying, yeah, it's liquid nitrogen. I get that confused with nitrate, but liquid nitrogen. Well, we look back in 24 hours, and if this hive has removed all the dead larvae, and we see only the, you know, mainly just empty cells there in a 3-inch circle, we know that hive is very hygienic. If we go back and nothing of the dead larvae has been removed, it gets taken off the list. It isn't real hygienic. And the premise behind this is that a more hygienic hive will get rid of not only, if they get rid of dead larvae, the premise is they will also be able to detect various, maybe spores of American foul brood, maybe reproductive mites in sealed brood chambers, and remove all that foreign matter from the hive, getting rid of pest and bacteria, and running a much healthier hive. So that is a good question. That's something that's very important. And to answer you, I would say yes. I do think the bees are adapting. I do think we find that they will survive. They will make greater strides to overcome this. You have another question in your email, Chris, about do I think that the this hygienic behavior will cause a repopulation of the feral bees. I don't know. Feral bee populations were so decimated in the 90s, and something happened. I don't want to get too much into this and confuse our listeners, so I'll try to make it simple. But prior to the mites, we had a great diversity of stock because we did have those a genetic line of feral bees. They were just bees that were brought over many, many years ago, and you know, they escaped and swarmed and flew off into the wild. And in the wild, we had all these feral hives that were continuing to swarm and reproduce themselves, and this gave us a great diversity of genetics. And when all those feral hives were decimated by the mites, it reduced our genetic lines tremendously. We no longer have what I call survival stock, feral bees that are surviving in the wild without any intervention of man or medication and such. And so as a result of that, we have limited to some degree, maybe to a great degree, our gene diversity in the honeybees. And this is alarming, and I think that this can be restored in the same way that it was eventually brought about in early America, because honeybees are not native to America. They were brought over. And so as a result of that, I believe if we can restore the bee population to a certain threshold, well, then we're going to replenish feral hives, because even the best beekeepers cannot prevent their bees from swarming. And when they swarm, they often go and find a tree or a bush or something that they'll, begin making their hive in. So I think we will see a return of the feral bee population in time. And it will bring about, again, the diversity of bees that we need, the genetics that we need. And the answer is getting more people to keep bees like yourself, Chris, and just having more people taking the plunge and becoming beekeepers. Wow, that's the best way to do it. All right. Oh, let's go to another email. Let's see. This one comes from Keith. He says, good morning, Dave. While surfing around the net, learning about different types of hives that were and are still used in the world, I came across one hive called, I'm not sure how to pronounce this. I want to say war, could be war, but it's W-A-R-R-E, the war hive, named after Emil War. And this is interesting that you bring up, Keith. You go on in your email and talk about a book that was written by War about beekeeping for all. This particular type of hive that you're mentioning here is a top bar hive. It's what you find in many third world countries. That it's shaped, how do you describe it on radio? Kind of like an upside down triangle is the way the hive is shaped. And if you were to take the top, and it's long, it's longer than our Langstroth hives. It's probably almost twice as long. Maybe the same size at the top, but it goes down to not an exact point, but it goes down to maybe 2-3 inches, 4 inches at the bottom. I don't know the exact measurements. I'm trying to give you a picture here. And instead of putting frames in there, you simply put the top bar of a frame. It rests on the top, just like it does on a Langstroth hive. And the theory behind this is that the bees will build their comb onto these top bars. They'll attach it to the side walls of this upside-down triangle down to the floor, and they'll go in and out the bottom and go up into their comb. And there are many people. I mean, there's an avid following, just a huge amount of people out there experimenting with these top bar hives, and they've been using them for years. Some people love them. Here in the state of Illinois, it is, in my opinion, it is illegal to use them. Now, I don't know what the position of the Department of Agriculture is. I do know they're in their book of rules on beekeeping that we must follow. It says that all hives must have inspectable, removable frames. You can't do that with these types of frames. In fact, this is one of the things that you'll read about in the war hive, the top bar hive, is the premise is that if we can get the bees to attach this comb to the side of the wall and build their allow them to attach it, allow them to build burr comb, kind of put it all together, then they're more productive. Now, the people that really advocate this type of hive, whenever I discuss this issue of not being able to remove the combs, they always say, oh no, yeah we can, and there's no laws against it, it's fine. But if you really get into the details of this and read, especially I think this book, I believe it's a man, Emil, I don't think it's Emily, I think it's Emil, E-M-I-L-E, but you'll see that they describe that you don't want to intrude into this hive any more than you absolutely have to. And basically, to be honest with you, it is like the old skeps that we used to, well, we didn't, but beekeepers used to use years ago. And they would simply have to kind of tear the hive up to remove honey. And so I'm not too excited about this type of hive, Keith, to be honest with you, because you can't remove the frames for inspection. We promote a 2-week minimal inspection of your hive to make sure your queens are doing good, make sure you got good eggs, make sure you don't have any problems in there. And I'm afraid if more beekeepers started using this type of hive and inspect their hive less and less, there could be a spread of disease or problems. It could be a challenge. I certainly would not recommend it for a new beekeeper at all. So thanks for writing, Keith. Here's another email from Rachel, and doesn't say where she's from yet anyway. Don't see it. It says, hello, my name is Rachel. For a project in my biology class, we have to contact a professional beekeeper. Huh. I wonder if she considers me professional. I certainly don't. Anyway, we have to contact a professional beekeeper, so it would be really helpful to me and my group if you could answer a few questions and email me back as soon as possible. Okay, well, I'll do that, and I'll also answer her questions here on Studio B Live, because I think all of us could benefit from her questions and answers that I'll give on that. Okay, question number one. What role do honeybees play in pollination, and why is it so important? I love that question. Honeybees play such a major role in pollination. In fact, it's estimated that one out of every three bites of food is a result of honeybee population. Orchards and melon farmers, they're desperately seeking more honeybees. They can't get the crops to produce like they once did when there were feral bees. They can't get the apples that they used to get when there were more bees. They can't even, some melon farmers beg us to bring honeybees to their melon patches because honeybees have to pollinate melons. And in California, almond growers are required to have 2 hives per acre for adequate pollination. And even if you think about this, even our daily food and meats, our dairy foods, for example, milk, I mean, would all be jeopardized without honeybees because cattle eat the food that the bees pollinate. And so it's vital to our survival. Okay, the second question is, what are some commercial products that are made by bee byproducts? Oh my, there's just so many. I wouldn't even begin to scratch the surface. You think of the different resources that come from the hive, namely honey, but also beeswax, pollen, royal jelly, and propolis. And these all have such a vital role. They're beginning to use propolis in the medical industry. And royal jelly has always been a highly precious resource from the beehive that many people consume, thinking that it brings, you know, them health. And there is a lot of, I read about that in a broadcast or two ago about royal jelly and how good it is for you and whether or not anyone wants to be brave enough to eat it. But it does come in capsules. It comes in, you know, it comes in different kind of, I think you can buy it in the herb section. Pollen is the same way. Many people eat pollen. Athletes think pollen gives them greater strength. Beeswax is just used in an unbelievable amount of products. You think of candles. You think of different kind of lip balm and hand lotions and cosmetics, and the list goes on. By the way, propolis, there's a very expensive violin that's made by a company, and they actually take propolis and incorporate it into their finish of this violin. It's pretty amazing. But, you know, beeswax, we have customers who buy beeswax, and they use it on musical instrument, some of the string instruments. They use it to, a lot of people use it to wax coat things. You can use it for sticky doors. You know, if you got wooden cabinets that drawers pulling it out, you can just rub a little beeswax on there and things move more smoothly. A lot of different applications for these products that come from the beehive, and I have only touched the surface. I guess if you look at Burt Bees, you see these products that Burt Bees, this company called Burt Bees, that they make almost every kind of product you can imagine from the beehive. Number three, what are some possible reasons for the decrease in the honeybee population? What are some problems the bees are facing leading to the decline of their species. Well, colony collapse disorder has been around for many years, and it's been under different names. It's been called fall dwindle disease. Difficult to know what the cause of this round of the disease is. In my opinion, though, it's found mainly in migratory colonies, and some of these migratory beekeepers have been known to use chemicals that have not been FDA approved for bees and their hives. And it's my opinion that these various chemicals have become absorbed in the wax comb, which finally caused the bees to abandon their hive. I'm no expert at all, and I know we have many experts working on this. But if you look at what we find with colony collapse disorder, you don't find it typically in the hobbyist beekeeper's beehives or the backyard beekeeper. You find it more in larger migratory beekeeping operations. And I think there are many factors leading to the CCD crisis, and I think that's just one of them, the way that the bees are treated with chemicals and it gets absorbed in the comb. I think another factor is the stress that is placed on bees by being shipped around. Think about it. You know, migratory beekeepers take their bees on semis to one particular type of crop and leave them there for however long it takes, maybe a week or two or a month. And then they pick them up and move them to another crop and leave them there for a while. Pick them up, move them to another crop. You know, you're on almonds for 2 weeks, and then you're on apples for 2 weeks. And then you're on, orange trees for a month. I mean, I don't know. It just, to me, doesn't seem to make a healthy bee. If I eat fries for 2 weeks from McDonald's, and then the next 2 weeks I eat potato chips, and then the next 2 weeks I eat bubble gum, you know, it's not very healthy. And I think these are all factors, and it's just the stress of being toted around. I think all these factors play a very important role in discovering what is causing these bees to have CCD. And also, I do not believe in treating the honey beehive with antibiotics, and I think this is just devastating to the bees. They're finding, and the researchers are finding that when they look at bees, they're amazed how their immune systems are so weak and how many viruses, bacteria that the bees have. No wonder. There are some beekeepers, and I know some of you listening are in this category. You're on the medicine treadmill. You live to feed your bees medicine. You dump fumigillin in there. Fumigillin B in there, in case they might have nosema. You dump Tylen or Terramycin in there to prevent American foul brood. You're not preventing anything. You're just keeping it from vegetating if it's in there. And once you have to stop this medication, it's going to vegetate. What are you doing? You're just treating your bees with antibiotics, and they really don't need it. Try that with your doctor. If you're healthy, go to your doctor now and say, "Hey, doc, I'm a healthy guy, aren't I?" "Yeah, you sure are. I need some antibiotics." "Why?" "Because I believe that if I take antibiotics, I won't get sick." He's not going to write you a prescription. He won't do it. He'll say, "No way, I'm not going to give you a prescription if you're not sick." "Why?" And he'll say, "Because if you take antibiotics, you will suppress your own immune system." I even had a doctor one time tell me this. He said, "David," he said, "You just had the flu. Antibiotics don't work against this type of flu virus. And if I allow you to get over this virus on your own with your own body's immunity, you'll be more immune to it next time." Then why can't we do this for our bees? Come on. It just makes sense. Doesn't anybody have the same logical thinking that I do? I mean, if this works in the medical field with humans, why give bees antibiotics when they don't need it? Huh. I don't know. I mean, that's just a thought. It makes sense to me. But to answer question number three, Rachel, bees are declining, And I think more, you know, certainly we would say CCD has made them decline, mites, tracheal mites, Ferrara mites. But I think more than anything else is that years ago, most farmers and rural folks out in the country had a hive or two. There were a lot of feral hives that we talked about earlier in the wild. Mites killed off the feral hives, and now most of the honeybees found in the U.S. are hives kept by beekeepers. And the answer is to restore our honeybee population by more people listening to Studio Bee Live and more people saying, huh, I want to try beekeeping. There you go. All right, number four. What are some solutions to the decline in honeybees? What is the honeybee genome doing? All right. To reduce the decline in honeybee population, we must have better insecticide management with greater sensitivity on how insecticides are used and how they're weakening honeybees. You just can't go flying crop dusters across the landscape spraying insecticides and making the bees sick or knocking them off. And even if the aerial sprayers are keeping their spray on a farmer's field, keep in mind bees fly 3 miles away. They can be in flight when they and get sprayed. And we really do need to give more attention to this. Other countries are. Other countries have strict guidelines about this because they have a little bit more understanding of the important role of honeybees than seems like the U.S. does. But we need better management. I'm not saying that I love farmers. I understand farmers had a right to manage their crops using chemicals if they see fit. But I think we do need a cooperation of farmers working with beekeepers. And we're surrounded by farm fields here. My farmer is great. He doesn't use insecticides or pesticides. And he understands. He always talks with me about what his crops may or may not how they may or may not affect my bees, and I appreciate that. But I think we do have to reduce the amount of medication beekeepers use, like I said, with antibiotics. This is important, too. The surest way to increase the honeybee population in the U.S. is for more people to start keeping bees. Now, what is it doing? Well, you know, I guess the theory behind this is if you can develop more gene markers, if you can develop more, understand more of the genetic of the bees' makeup of their genes, then you can detect, kind of like we do with our own bodies, if we discover a gene that may cause people to be more prone to cancer, then there can be some type of preventative measure made about that. So this is how it's being applied toward the bees as well. To be honest with you, I'm not real impressed with genome projects yet. I don't know why, because it hasn't really, as far as I've seen, had that much effect on the average beekeeper yet. I think it might, and I think it will. I think it's a good place to go. And I know there's huge grants and bee labs doing these projects, and I think overall in the long term it could be beneficial to us. But as of yet, I mean, right now the average beekeeper isn't feeling any, to the best of my knowledge, we're not feeling any result of that yet. But I think a lot of these projects are still pretty early and new. So we'll have to, the jury's still out, we'll wait and see. All right. What role do honeybees play in the big picture of the food chain, and what effects do they have on other organisms in the food chain? I answered that in number one. And number six, what are 4 negative consequences of increasing the bee population? There are no negative consequences of increasing the bee population. None. I mean, if people are going to say, oh yeah, there'd be more bees, we get stung more. So what? During the early 1900s, when the bees were very prolific, people got stung. I mean, but there are no problems, no worse problems than today with less bees. I mean, you know, big deal. So, I mean, it's like saying if you drink too much water, it can be bad for you. So let's get rid of all the water. You can't do that. You just manage things properly. So I don't see any negative effects at all in having more bees. All right, thanks, Rachel, for writing to us. And I'll be sure and email her all those things, too, for her class, for her study. That's good. Rachel, let us know, too, if you're doing it for your high school biology class for a project. Let us keep us informed. I'd be interested to see what that project does. All right, here's another email. This is interesting. This is from Laura from Virginia, and she's from some Department of Technology Center. Anyway, she writes, I am writing to ask permission to use one of your pictures in a learning module for my school district. Oh, she wants a picture of me. Why would she want a picture of me for a high school learning module? Let's see what kind of a picture she wants. We are creating learning modules to help students with reading comprehension strategies. In a specific module, we are using an excerpt from The Secret Life of Bees, you know, that's the new movie out, and we discuss using context clues to understand what supers are. I came across a couple of your pictures of beehives from your website that would work perfectly for this scenario. We would gladly cite you as a resource if you give us permission to use the image. Oh, so she doesn't want a picture of me. She wants a picture of my supers. Well, Laura, you can certainly use any pictures you want to from our website. We don't care. All right, let's see. That's the same email. Must have printed off twice. Okay, well, that's some emails that have been coming in. Let's make one final check of the computer before we close down the email section. And, all right, there are no more. So there you go. If you do have questions that you would like to ask, write in. You can email me at david@honeybeesonline.com and ask your question. David@honeybeesonline.com. Or you can call us, and we really do love your phone calls more than your email, because we would rather hear your voice than for me to read your email. The phone number to call is 217-427-2430. Just wait for the tone and say, hi, this is Bob, and I'm wondering if, you know, ask your question. I think you only get about 30 to 45 seconds, so make it short and sweet. Thanks for going along with me through these emails. I hope they've been informative, the answers. And do email us your questions. And now it's time for the equipment section of our broadcast. Okay, in regards to equipment, we've been looking at all the different pieces on the beehive, going from the top all the way down to the bottom, and we are just about done. I promised you today that I would talk about the entrance cleat. The entrance cleat is a 3/4 by 3/4 by 3/4 by 3/4 block of wood. It's a little, just a kind of a square, long rectangle piece of wood. And in this piece of wood, there are two notches about halfway through the wood. Those of you that are carpenters know that halfway through 3/4 is about 3/8. And so these notches are about 3/8. And remember what 3/8 is, class? Students, what is 3/8 of an inch? You got it, B space. Meaning that if there is a gap that's 3/8 of an inch, they will not put burr comb there, and they will not put propolis there. They will leave it open as a travel path, 3/8 of an inch. And on this block of wood, it fits right into the opening of the front of your hive. Now, a lot of people look at this, and they become real technical. Oh, my goodness. When should I use my entrance cleat? When should I use a small setting? When should I use a large setting? They feel like this is the brain of the hive, that this is the heart, that this is that the whole hive centers and revolves around the entrance cleat. Well, get a clue, it doesn't. You're not going to be able to mess up because you didn't do your entrance cleat right. Bees are going to go in and out. If they want to go in and out, they'll go in and out of a small hole if they have to. Or they'll go out a big hole. Doesn't matter. So basically, though, there is a theory, a philosophy behind the entrance cleat. And here's what it is. Use your entrance cleat, certainly in the wintertime, when you want to keep mice out and cold north winds from blowing in the door. And in this case, I used the small setting. It's about an inch, three-quarter of an inch wide opening in this block of wood. I push it in my opening. So now the bees, when they go in and out, they can only go out that little bitty hole there. I put the hole, remember I said it's 3/8 into this wood, so the other part is solid in the opening. I put this opening up so that when the dead bees fall to the floor of the bottom board, the sisters, when they want to go out, they can crawl over them and still get out. If you put it upside down where the opening faces down, then the dead bees can block the opening. And you'll have to go out there and clean out dead bees. So that's the first major part of the entrance cleat when you would use it. Okay. Now, the other larger opening, when would you use that? Well, you can use it in the wintertime, too, if you want to give them maybe a 2 or 3 inch opening. Wouldn't hurt a thing. A mouse might squeeze in there. Kind of doubt it. Possible, though. Those little creatures can really get in tight spots. You could certainly use the larger, wider opening. If you installed a package and you want them to kind of stay in your hive a day, but a few of them kind of come and go, maybe cut down on them leaving, that would be okay to use that. By the way, the smaller opening, you can use that too in the summertime if you're feeding your bees and all at once you see they're being robbed by another beehive down the road. You can put this block, this entrance cleat, back in and set it to the smallest entrance. It will give your bees less opening to protect. They'll do a better job protecting and guarding a smaller opening than a larger opening. The best way to use the entrance cleat, and one that you look forward to using, is removing it and storing it somewhere so your bees can have the full opening of their beehive, hauling in huge amounts of surplus honey that you'll enjoy. So that's basically what the entrance cleat is for. It's just a tool for you to control how large of an opening your bees have. And to be honest with you, a lot of people don't even use them. They leave things open all winter long, all summer. Not a big deal. Got an incoming message. So, and another aspect of the equipment that I want to talk about today, and one I don't think I mentioned, is the queen excluder. Hey, let's hear it for the queen excluder. I need a sound bite of people applauding or booing. I would boo. I boo. Queen excluders, boo. Friend, I just don't like them. All right, I agree with whoever invented the term honey excluder. That was their definition of a queen excluder. It's a honey excluder. Here's the idea. Here's what a queen excluder, what a queen excluder is for. You have two deep hive bodies in central Illinois. I know some of you only run one in southern states, but here in central Illinois, two hive bodies. And this is where your bees live. This is where they raise their young. This is where they take their kids to school parties. This is where they have Boy Scout and, well, I guess it'd be Girl Scouts. Maybe the drones don't have a Boy Scout group. But all your bees reside in these two little boxes. And your queen's in there, she's laying eggs, and everybody's just busy, you know, doing their jobs. Now, they have honey in that area because they eat it. They use it to feed their young. That's what they survive on. But they are bees, and they're busiest bees. They make more honey than they need to. And this is where you come in. You want to put an extra super on top of that apartment complex and let those bees store your honey above their honey. And they will. They're glad to do it. But one problem. The queen wants to lay eggs. That's her job. She has a mission, and she has chosen to accept it. And she is going to lay eggs wherever she can. Thousands a day. That's right. 1,000 to 3,000 eggs laid a day. Well, guess what? She's looking for space. And if you put your honey super on top of that apartment complex, the queen can go right up there and lay eggs where you were hoping to have honey. So now you're like, oh, my honey, I can't harvest it because there's larvae in it. So someone invented the queen excluder. You lay it on top of your two deeps, the apartment complex, and then you put your super on top of that. The queen excluder divides this area. The queen goes up. She's larger than all the other bees. She can't squeeze through the wire screen, and therefore she goes back down and just is content to lay in the two deep bodies below. So the idea of the queen excluder is that the queen can't make it through the screen, but the workers can. But I've learned this. Yeah, the workers can, but a lot happens when they have to squeeze through that little screen. And I have tried it, and I didn't like it. And then I said, well, maybe that was just not a good hive to try it on. I'll try it on a different... I've tried a queen excluder 3 years in a row now. Boo. Just no good honey production when you have those queen excluders on there. So here's what I do. Now, a queen has to have a perfectly clean cell to lay an egg in. She's really particular about that, friend. She's not going to lay an egg in a cell full of honey because the egg would die. It would suffocate. And so when you put your super on, and especially if you don't have any drawn comb, if it's just foundation, you're going to have to wait until your bees can draw the super foundation out to make a comb before they can put honey in it. And even before the queen could lay in it, of course, too. So all I do is this. I monitor where my queen is in the hive. If you're going to be a good beekeeper, don't be afraid. None of the bees care that you're watching the queen or that you're handling her. They don't care. All right? Don't think that they're going to attack you because you're messing with their queen. They don't care. You can pick her up and walk off with her. They'll never bother you. So what you want to do is monitor where your queen is. And you can do this either by looking at your queen, finding her, or just looking where she's laying eggs. If you see eggs, you know the queen is in that area. And all I do is, when I put a honey super on, I'm going to make sure that my bees have time to draw the comb out. So I'll put a honey super on. When I put my honey super on of empty foundation, non-drawn foundation, I don't care where the queen is then. She's not going to lay on my non-drawn foundation. And I put that on there, and I'll wait maybe a week. Not more than a week. I'll let them draw that comb out. And then I go out there, and I look at it, make sure the queen's not walking around up there. And then I look at I take that off, and then I look at my deep hive body and try to find my queen. And I say, oh, there's my queen. She's in my top deep hive body. I got two deep. She's in the top one. I pick her up with my fingers. I just grab her by her wings, and I hold her, and I take her and put her in the front door of her same hive. She walks back in on the very bottom. Now I put my honey super back on, and my queen is content to be down below the honey super in the two deeps, laying again, probably finding a lot of empty places down there in the lower deep. And in the meantime, all my foragers, they're bringing honey into this drawn super, and they're putting honey in it. Now, if the queen makes her way up to the honey super, like a week or two later, she makes her way up, and she realizes, I want to lay more, maybe I'll lay up in this open space, the honey super. But what does she find? Cells full of honey. She's not going to lay there. It's what we call a honey barrier. Some people call it a honey dome. And so at that point, she'll just return. She will go back down and just find ample room in the two deeps. So it's a better practice, in my opinion, to monitor your queen and manipulate her location away from the super than it is for you to use a queen excluder. All right. So that's a couple of thoughts on the queen excluder. I know some of you are new beekeepers and you don't want to touch the queen. You don't want to mess with that. Oh, my goodness, I don't want to go that deep into the hive. I just want to stay on the outer perimeters like the super. I don't want to look at the nest. It's scary. No, it's not. It's okay. It's fine. You'll enjoy it. Get familiar with your bees and learn to spot your queen and know her location and manage her where she's at so she won't lay up in your super. If you see her up in the super, if you see she's laid a little bit up there, no problem. Pick her up. Put her back in the entrance down below. And in a few days, in 21 days, all those little workers are going to hatch. They're going to abandon the honey super. All your other workers are going to clean their cells up and fill it full of honey. So no big deal either. It's not totally a loss. So there you go. Queen is gluter and the entrance cleat. And that's the equipment section today. And now it's time for a look back in history.
And now it's time for Back in History.
We're looking at a beekeeper by the name of J. Smith, who lived in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And yesterday we looked into some of his words that he wrote in his book entitled Better Queens. And we're looking at this book again. It's available for download on bushfarms.com. J. Smith's book has been placed on that site. I assume it's out of copyright. You can't find this book anymore, and I'm on the hunt for it. If you find it, let me know. But I downloaded it and printed it off. I've got all these pages, you know, that are floating around. You don't want to do that if you're going to read this book in a windy place. If you printed it off on your computer, better put it in a three-ring binder or something. But it's a great book. And listen to what J. Smith says about raising queens. In this section of his book, the title is, Shall the Beekeeper Rear His Own Queens? My answer to that is emphatically yes. This is from J. Smith. He says emphatically yes, providing he can rear the best of queens. Maybe some member of the family, a boy or girl, or yes, maybe mother, may rear queens and find it not only the most profitable work about the bee yard, but they will get a world of pleasure in doing it. Many will make a larger profit from half the number of colonies if they rear their own queens. Therefore, instead of being more work to rear their own queens, it really would be less work for the time saved in caring for double the number of colonies, not to mention the larger amount of money invested. Let me give you just one instance. In California, I had the privilege of observing the system of two beekeepers who worked in opposite lines. One had 2,000 colonies. When a colony died from becoming queenless, the beekeeper divided another colony. In one division was the queen, and the other the bees were expected to rear a queen. Sometimes they did, but having only old comb, the resultant queens were not the best. He had to hire a large crew of men to take care of all these colonies to see that they did not die out. In addition, the interest of the investment and interest of the money invested in the large equipment was considerable. And if you consider the depreciation, that was an additional expense. In contrast to this, I met a man in Ventura County who had about 250 colonies. This man and his son reared their own queens and requeened every year. He told me that year their colonies averaged 200 pounds per colony, and they sold the honey wholesale for 22 cents per pound. Remember, this is early 1900s. It sells for about $4 a pound now. It was plain this man and his son made more money from the 250 colonies than the man who operated the 2,000. Now, isn't that interesting? Wow. Now, this is something I always advocate and something you need to really hear me on. Please requeen your hive every year. It's not a big deal. These younger queens that are new, they have a stronger pheromones odor. They have a stronger tendency to lay much better in their early years. And so if you replace a queen yearly, you'll have much better results, I believe, with your beehive. There'll be less swarming. You'll have a prolific amount of eggs, and thus you'll have more foragers to make more honey. And I even think, it's my opinion, that a newer queen will have a greater tendency for the colony to resist disease or pests, because stronger colonies that are the result of a better laying queen will be larger in number, and a larger hive is just more apt to fight off wax moths, small hive beetle, mites, and bacteria. And so that's why I think it's in, it's just so important. It is essential that you requeen your hive once a year. You can do it in the spring. That would be fine. You can do it late in the year, like October, September, or October if you can get by that late. But September is a good month, too. And you can take a fresh new queen into the winter months with her new the eggs that she lays in late summer or fall. And you have a better chance to overwinter as well. And so that's a look back in history from the book Better Queens by Jay Smith. And we're completely out of time today. It's time for us to sign off. I want to thank you for tuning in today. Before I go, let me tell you about our upcoming bee class here at Long Lane Honeybee Farms. We'd love to have you join us. We are having four students sign up for this class. We do limit these classes to around 15 students, and so we just have a few spots still open. The class will be coming up February the 21st from 9 to 3, and it's on a Saturday. We'd love to have you. The cost is $85, and you can call us to register. The number is 217-427-2678. The number again, 217-427-2678. Come on up February the 21st, or come on down, depending on where you live. Spend the day with me and Sherry, and we'll tell you all about beekeeping, how to get you started. Or if you are an experienced beekeeper, you're sure to learn even more to help you with your beekeeping knowledge and skills. So do give us a call to register for our upcoming beekeeping class, February the 21st. The number to call is 217-427-2678. Visit us online. Our website is honeybeesonline.com, honeybeesonline.com. You can always email me at david@honeybeesonline.com. And if you'd like to ask a question, just email it to me or give us a call. We have an information question and answer line that you can call. The number is 217-427-2430. State your name and your question, and we'll play it on an upcoming broadcast. The number to call is 217-427-2430. I'll see you next time, and until then, remember to behave yourself.